Hello and welcome to the Gateway House podcast. My name is Vipratap Vikram Singh. I'm a website manager here at Gateway House. And today we will be ending our special podcast series on the US election. We have Ambassador Neelam Deo here with us.
Delighted to be on, Veer.
And as all of us have been watching through the day, Donald Trump has successfully become the president-elect of the United States, having secured more than the 270 required delegates to become the president-elect. We wanted to break down the results as soon as we could, so we've got Neelam here to help demystify and help us understand the situation. So Neelam, right, just to begin with, in the days building up to the election, we saw a lot of polls coming out which always presented a Hillary Clinton victory. This election, much like an earlier upset in 2016 with Brexit, has seen polls, hard data driven polls proven wrong. In the last episode that we did of this series, you brought in the element of hidden votes. So I just want to come back to that and understand, how much did this hidden vote play into this election?
Well, this has been the biggest political upset in recent history anywhere in the world, much bigger and much more important than Brexit, which preceded it by a few months. There's no question that the pollsters got everything wrong, both for Brexit and in the case of the American election, where they had shown not just occasionally Hillary Clinton ahead of Trump, but consistently for months they had shown her in a 4-6% lead. What does this mean and why? It clearly means that the hidden vote that we spoke about earlier was a much bigger element than anybody had understood. And one of the explanations for it, because Trump was such an unlikely candidate, he said things which were critical of Hispanics, of African Americans, of a disabled reporter, of women, of Muslims. He was such an unlikely candidate, and certainly such an unlikely winner, that perhaps a lot of people who agreed with him on the basics were not keen to say so in public, and certainly not to say so to anonymous pollsters, who in any case we should remember were always a little shaky, in that if the poll was on telephone, you got one set of results, and if the poll was on email, you got a slightly different result. So actually all of us, who try to analyze and understand these events should have been more wary. But it also means two or three things. One is, of course, who was this hidden vote across the United States that did not vote for Hillary Clinton, who spoke very reasonably on immigration reform, who was very placatory on for the Hispanics, whose husband, and in fact President Obama himself, canvassed hugely for the African-American vote, for women, all of those things. It's obvious that independent voters have flocked to the Trump campaign. It would also appear that fairly large numbers of African-Americans who did not turn out in strength for Hillary Clinton as they did for Obama, have actually, because they are conservative in their opinions, have voted for Trump rather than Hillary Clinton. It also means that quite a percentage of Hispanics, probably the Cuban Americans in Florida, which Trump carried, have voted for him, even though they were lumped in with Hispanics and expected to vote for Hillary Clinton. The surprise element, though details are not yet available, is that a large number of women also voted for Republican, whereas the conventional wisdom and all of our wisdom was that they would be so repelled by the kind of remarks and attitudes on women attributed to Trump. So I think we have to understand that all of these things mattered But what mattered most in the end was the unhappiness, the resentment, the unease that wide swathes of the population in the United States felt at their economic condition. Loss of jobs, loss of good, well-paying jobs, a lot of people having to do two or three low-paying jobs. And actually, Hillary Clinton should perhaps have known better, because people will recall that Bill Clinton's campaign slogan was, "It's the economy, stupid."
Well, I mean, when we look at the final results, it certainly seems that the Republican Party or the GOP has actually managed to really win everything that they could have possibly had hoped for. I mean, not only has their candidate become president, but they've also managed to win and continue holding the United States Senate and the Congress. In fact, as you mentioned, the strong Cuban American voter presence could easily be, and their votes could easily be attributed to Marco Rubio, who stayed in Florida in the running and won Florida, presumably. So now that the Republicans have won both not only the presidency, but the United States Congress and Senate, what does this mean for America? What are the kind of benefits and implications that this has?
So, if it were not Trump, I think we would say that it's very good. He can get quite a lot of legislative agenda through, and certainly the first couple of years of presidency have often been the most productive in the past. The problem this time, or rather I would say the complication this time, is that Trump ran against the Republican Party. The leadership in the Republican Party actually repudiated him. You know, you will recall that Paul Ryan, who is the leader of the House, said that first he said he would vote for Trump, then he said he might not, then he said he would actually spend all his energies on canvassing for down ballot candidates, so other Republicans who were standing. And so what we might see now is whether the Republican Party, the Republican establishment, can be reconciled, whether Trump is open to being reconciled with them, since he has won this election really with himself and his family campaigning for him most of all. Of course, there have been others, Republicans like Newt Gingrich or Rudy Giuliani, or even the former governor of New Jersey. But these are not people that the Republican Party regarded as its own. So we will have to see whether Trump and the Republican Party are able to come together, or whether the Republican Party will actually thwart him in the House and the Senate. I think that given that many Republicans, including members of the House, including former Republican establishment people, who had said that they would not vote for Trump at all, have clearly come along and supported and voted for him. So perhaps that may smooth the path. But at least in the beginning, it will not be so easy for Trump to work with the US Congress at this time.
Now, another interesting pattern which seems to have really come out during this election is, the kind of results that it's had in the electoral turnout and the kind of voter demographics which have the voting patterns which have happened across the United States, and it seems almost reflective of what we've seen as well with experts in media, where tremendous amount of media houses and experts were affirming that Hillary Clinton's going to win, that you should vote for Hillary. And we can see that in especially in places like Washington DC, where there was a tremendous Democrat vote. But now, what does it mean for this intellectual establishment of experts in media? They're saying one thing, but the people are voting a completely different direction.
Quite right. It's a tremendous phenomenon which we have to try to understand and analyze. But the trust that people have in experts and the media has been eroding globally over time. This was reflected also in Brexit, This was reflected also in the election of Modi in India, where the English language media and television were not in favor of Modi. So it is a fact that there is some level of condescension on the part of experts and the media, because the media is no longer just reporting. It is also the experts themselves. And the experts and media have now become a revolving door. You know, experts are on the media all the time. The media is also writing expert papers. There is some level of condescension within these the media and the experts towards people who, you know, for want of a better word, would be described as sons of the soil, or more people who speak the language of people who are not necessarily the most highly educated and not necessarily the most sophisticated and well placed, but who are clearly much the larger numbers. And in a democracy, finally, it's a numbers game. So I think we will see a continued erosion in the respect that the media and experts, think tankers as well, like us, enjoy in a wider society, who anywhere does not read the output of think tanks or when the media is over clever.
You know, you're touching on what I guess we could call the inelasticity of the Trump voter, where you have a situation where, you know, the media would consistently came out with points that would have otherwise completely stonewalled any other political candidate. I mean, you know, comments on that a candidate had assaulted women, that, you know, they were Islamophobic, that they were being racist, that they were making comments that were definitely not politically correct, would have resulted in that candidate like definitely not winning an election like this. So, I mean, how do we explain this kind of a phenomenon where regardless of any bad news that came, this outsider candidate was just able to really push through and like deal with it all?
Well, I would look at it in two or three different ways. One is that without question, Trump has had the white vote. A lot of the media and experts have described that as the last stand of the white male. Now, is it the last stand or not? We can only know as we go along to the next election and the next election in the United States. So that is one aspect. He did have the continued loyalty and support from especially white men, but now it transpires also white women. The other thing is that perhaps the Republican Party itself, when it analyzed its loss to Obama, may have overplayed the demographic changes, because they, in that report, they had written that any candidate can no longer win without support in the Hispanic community, without support from African Americans, and without support from millennials. So we know that barely half of the American electorate actually voted, even though this time there was a higher turnout than in previous elections. Now, we don't know as yet what percentage of African Americans actually voted or did not vote, whether the Hispanics actually turned out in large numbers or did not. But it's also possible that millennials who were enthused only by Bernie Sanders in the Democratic campaign did not come out to vote at all for Hillary Clinton or for Trump in this case. So those kinds of factors might help us to understand this vote. But most of all, it will have to be understood in terms of the immense dissatisfaction with their own economic condition, and even more with their economic prospects. You know, this generation of Americans describes itself as the first who will leave their children worse off financially than they themselves were. There's also huge, you know, student indebtedness, all kinds of other factors which contribute to this huge frustration against the establishment. And Hillary Clinton was the establishment candidate.
Now you're bringing the discussion back to finance, which is what the next question was going to be on, which is, you know, what is the short term or and even possibly long term impact that this is going to have on the US and in fact the world economy. The Asian markets have been open as the results came out, and there's definitely been a response. Most of Southeast Asia and East Asian stock exchanges have shown a significant, not a significant, but maybe 1 or 2% dip in stocks. But you know, just to get a bit of a financial perspective, since that was a key voter priority, what does this mean for the US economy in the short term?
You know, in the short term, this is global uncertainty, and markets don't like uncertainty. In the American case, it's going to be a little more complex because he had really two very important promises which will impact the stability in the American economy. One is the promise to overturn Obamacare on the first day of his presidency. So on that, I think we have to try and understand that in terms of the size of the medical establishment or the whole healthcare sector and health insurance, etc. I think it's somewhere near 10% of the American economy. So we're talking about $1.5 trillion or more. That will create a degree of uncertainty, and one does not know how Trump will actually try to make the changes in the healthcare sector, which will become necessary if Obamacare is actually to be thrown out. The other you would think is a factor for stability, because he has promised lowering taxes on the rich and on corporations. But it's also a fact that the rich did not contribute greatly to his campaign, and certainly corporations did not, and especially IT, which actually contributed more to the Clinton campaign than to the Trump campaign. So I don't know how that will play out in the American economy, and what the ripples will be in the global economy. But there are a couple of other things which will cause even more uncertainty. That is that the American establishment, both in this case Trump and Clinton, and Bernie Sanders most of all, were against trade agreements. So the Trans-Pacific agreement with the East Asian and ASEAN countries and South American countries will not happen in this form and for quite a long time. The mega trade agreement with Europe also will certainly be stalled for some time. So this will add to the uncertainty in Europe that Brexit has already generated. India should not be unhappy with that, because we are not part of any of these mega trade agreements, and they would certainly have constrained our access to all of these markets if they had gone through under Obama. Of course, there is a small chance, I don't take it seriously, that Obama will still try to push through the Trans-Pacific agreement in the lame duck Congress before he hands over. But given how sweeping Trump's victory has been, I don't think there will be any support for it in among Republican or even Democratic congressmen. So these are all huge factors for uncertainty. And then there is the fact that globalization, understood, misunderstood, wrongly projected, will also be constrained, at least for some time, because this vote is an anti-immigrant vote, it's an anti-trade vote, it's all of those things. So I think these are the phenomena which will now play out. And there have been expert analysis, which we should discount like American voters discount, that this may actually lead to the global economy going into a recession, taken together with the fact that the Chinese economy has slowed down, and that Europe has been stagnant, but may now become even worse than that.
So you just mentioned things like, you know, the IT sector, and as well as, you know, what India's concern should be now. The last 2 years of India-US relations has really been encapsulated by the personal relation that Prime Minister Narendra Modi and President Barack Obama seem to share. Now, the very jingoistic way of putting it would be, if a Modi Obama success was there, could a Modi Trump success exist as well?
You know, I think there was quite a lot of comment that the Modi Obama friendship was a very strange phenomenon. They are two very different personalities. Prime Minister Modi has been very outward. He has was very touchy-feely, you know, what they hugging President Obama and other leaders, you know, Abe of Japan, etc. Whereas Obama is generally described as very, you know, cerebral, very austere, a quite different personality than Modi. And if they could hit it off, it seems to me that Modi and Trump are naturals. You know, they are extroverted, they are given to some level of exaggeration. They are very much people who go by their own instinct. And, you know, both of them have won big victories. And I don't see any reason
unexpected
why.
Unexpected victories
and
as well.
Very unexpected victories written off by the intellectual class of both countries. So there's no reason why they won't be friends. The other important thing to remember is that the Indo-US relationship has also been not underwritten but made progress because of bipartisan support in the US Congress. And that should continue. There's no reason why that won't continue. So I think we can look forward to, Trump and Modi being best friends.
Okay, well, that's good news for us in India and definitely for Indian businesses. So I guess with that, we'll call this podcast to an end. And Neelam, I'd like to thank you for all the time that you've put in for this podcast series. And
thank you, Veer, and a big shout out to Arjun, who has been devising all these difficult questions for us and working with us on the podcast series. Thank you.
Thank you. You've been listening to the Gateway House podcast. This is part of a special series on the US elections. We hope you enjoyed this series, and if you have any comments, please send them to website at gatewayhouse.in.